Coming up on This Week in Enterprise Tech, Google Fiber rolls out to a new city, kinda, Twitter gets sued, and we talk all about immersive telepresence. Twyatt on the set.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for This Week in Enterprise Tech is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Twyatt, This Week in Enterprise Tech, episode 34, recorded March 25th, 2013. Polly wants a camera. This episode of This Week in Enterprise Tech is brought to you by Ting.com. Ting is a new mobile phone service that makes sense. Save money with Ting. Pay for what you use, doesn't require a contract, and offers unlimited devices on one pooled plan. To save $25 on your first Ting device, visit enterprise.ting.com. That's enterprise.ting.com. And by GoToMeeting with HD Faces by Citrix, the powerfully simple way to meet and collaborate with colleagues and clients from anywhere. You can share the same screen and see each other face-to-face with HD video conferencing, even from an iPad. Sign up for your 30-day free trial today. Visit GoToMeeting.com, click on the Try It Free button, and use promo code ENTERPRISE. And by RingCentral. We do everything in the cloud. That's why I love my cloud-based phone system by RingCentral. Zero startup costs, and RingCentral is $20 per month per user. Try it now with a 30-day risk-free trial and buy one desk phone and get a second phone free up to 20 phones. Call 800-543-9980 or visit ringcentral.com and use our promo code TWIT. Welcome to Twyatt This Week in Enterprise Tech. It's the show dedicated to the enterprise professional, the IT pro, and the geek who just wants to know how the world is connected. I'm your host, Father Robert Ballasaire, the digital Jesuit, your guide to all things in the enterprise. And as always, I am joined by a stellar all-star cast, starting with someone in-house, Mr. Mitch Malilai from Polycom. Mitch, thank you very much for coming on.
Thank you, Padre. Thanks for having me.
Now, what is your position at Polycom?
I'm currently the SE manager for the Internet Telephony and Cloud Service Provider Group, supporting service providers across the country and Canada.
Right. And you are a longtime collaborator with both Chibert and I on Interop. So we've known you for like a decade now.
Nearly.
Yeah, you're a big telecom geek, which is why we brought you in. But of course, we've got our standard guests on the panel, starting with the ever-present, the ever-geeky, the geek in paradise, Mr. Brian Chi from ThinLinks. Brian, this is not your office. Where are you right now?
I'm home.
Okay, home's good. Home's good. And yeah, are you still waiting for the installation of how much power do you have coming in solar-wise?
Actually, it's a 7.6 kilowatt panel. It's actually 27 panels. And we actually put up a trellis work, and the panels go on top. So I actually get a covered patio, and I get to legally take a tax write-off on the whole thing.
I like this. And at some point, we're going to have to go over there to film the green geek in paradise. I mean, Hawaii, you got to have solar, right?
Yeah, actually, I was thinking about doing the broadcast from out there, but it's still raining.
Chibert, come on. You're going to let a little rain, a little water keep you from putting high voltage equipment outside?
Yeah,
shame on you. Shame on you. Well, let's go to our next panelist. We have, of course, Mr. Curtis Franklin from Enterprise Efficiency. Curtis, who was with me at Enterprise Connect last week. Curtis, how are you? You're still in Florida, yes?
I am in Florida, back in the lab at the swamp today, but recuperating from last week at Enterprise Connect, getting ready to head out on the road again next week. I'll be at the SNW conference at the Rosen Shingle Creek talking about big data and business intelligence. Should be a good show.
I love it. Big data, business intelligence, things that we actually care about. The last member of our panel, but certainly not the least, is the man who keeps us honest, the pulse of the internet generation, Mr. Oliver Rist. Oliver, oh, see, we may just smile already. Okay,
it gets better every time I come on this show.
How are you doing? Now, your standard answer is you're in Seattle and it's raining, but what is
Actually,
it like today?
No, we have a beautiful day. It's sunny. It's 61 degrees. I shouldn't be on the show. I should be out on the motorcycle, but you owe me cash.
Yes. At some point, we'll have to stream you on your motorcycle. It's actually nice to go on the road with the wrist. But let's get right to it.
we start with our first enterprise bite, and that is the over-the-weekend leak of details about Windows Blue. Now, this is something that people have been speculating about, what the next version of Windows 8 is going to be like. In fact, there were rumors about Windows Blue even before Windows 8 was released. All of the screenshots that we have shows that it has smaller tiles, that it has more integrated SkyDrive features, that it has added a few applications in the native Metro side, so a calendar and a calculator, the alarm, and even a movie maker. But I think the big feature is going to be 50-50 sharing. And actually, if Jason will go over to my screen, so this is what a standard Metro looks like right now. I have the ability to do things like this, which allows me to do a 80-20 split on either side of the display. What the new version is actually doing is it's allowing us to do a 50-50. This is sort of a concession to the people who, well, they want more windowing options in the Metro side. Now, my question to the panel, I'm going to start with you, Oliver, since you have such a history with Microsoft, is this something that you think will allow more people to put away the desktop and live solely in Metro? Or will people still want to use the desktop to use Windows as they did with Windows 7?
Well, first off, you're not supposed to call it Metro.
That's right.
I don't know what it's supposed to be called, but it's not Metro. Second off, can you show that picture again? Was that Jesus and his girlfriend?
This one?
No. Off to the other side, the bearded guy.
The bearded guy?
Yeah, he had a big bearded guy. That guy.
Yeah, absolutely. Yes, that is Jesus and his girlfriend. Okay.
All right. Good to know. I guess you have pull up there in heaven.
Of course.
Again, I have to come back to only if the application library for Metro, not Metro, grows. Currently, I still think that's their biggest weakness. The technology, I'm sure, would. But without the app selection, I don't see anyone living in Metro.
Right. Chibert, let me throw over to you. There were some rumors that perhaps Blue would allow people to default boot into the desktop side of Windows 8 and maybe even give us back the start button. Now, that didn't happen. We still don't have the start button. We still have that little charms bar. We still have a hybrid interface that boots directly into what I'm going to call Metro. I'm never going to stop calling it Metro. Do you think this is something that people are going to want? I mean, sure, it gives us a few refinements. You can do more things with your tiles. You have more control over the subtleties of your Metro interface. But it seems to me that Microsoft is really saying, no, we're not going back to Windows 7.
Actually, what I'm really puzzled about is when I got my original press releases about Windows 8 before it shipped, they were saying, well, you can do an install and you can choose the desktop as your default, or you can choose Metro as your desktop, or it'll open the market for third-party developers for custom GUI interfaces, which is, I thought, was going to be a great change, especially for the people that do embedded systems and kiosks and things like that. I'm a little disappointed. I feel like it was a bait and switch. Someone made a change, and I don't think it was for the better. The other thing that I miss, you know, I'm running a Mac OS X machine, and while I'm really thinking about moving back to Windows again, the thing that I'm going to miss the most is a feature called Spaces, where I can actually have multiple desktops. So I have all my chat tools in desktop one, my main browser, email, and so forth, and two and three, and it allows me to organize my system better. That's one thing I will miss when I move back to Windows.
Mm-hmm. Curtis, CR1 in the chat room has said that it has to be an improvement over the Windows 8 UI. But if they're not giving us things like the start button, if they're not giving us things like the ability to default into the desktop side of Windows 8, do you really consider it an improvement?
No, I think that there are two interesting things with this, and you know, let me preface this by saying that if all of this is accurate, to me the two interesting things are, first, that, as you say, it doesn't offer that lifeline back to the Win 7 interface. So it really is a commitment to not Metro or whatever the interface is called. This new tiled interface is being doubled down upon by Microsoft in the Blue release. Now, the second thing is, when you look at all of these are tablet-oriented changes. These are things that are designed to give someone using this on a touchscreen, on a tablet, more options and some of the things that they wanted. It does absolutely nothing for most people who would be using it on a laptop, on a traditional desktop sort of platform. And to me, that may be the more interesting thing, that Microsoft has heard all of the comments made by people, heard all of the criticisms, and all of the improvement here is in the direction of the mobile user, of the tablet user in particular. And I think that says a lot about where Microsoft sees the market going over the next few years. And that has huge implications for all the enterprise people out there.
Right, right. You know, the sad thing for me has been, I actually like Windows 8. It is far more stable. There have been so many improvements behind the scenes, behind the interface, that are really worthwhile. It's just the nagging things about the way they've designed the UI that I think are, you know, really big barriers to entry. Let me go over to you, Mitch, because you are sort of, you are the closest thing in this group to a real-world enterprise user. We all do things for our jobs, for technology. We try Windows 8. We try different OSs. You do things because they're productive, because they help you to work better.
Right.
Do you see a move to Windows 8 from Windows 7 now that they've made these changes?
You know, from an enterprise perspective, I don't. You know, there's still far more tools for the employee that's still based on Windows 7, and if I can say XP for that matter. But you're slowly seeing the progression, and I think, you know, you go into a Best Buy today, you see the wider selection of touchscreen tablets, and I think that's where a lot of the direction is headed. I think we're not there yet. Maybe in a couple months, half year, not sure.
Okay, yeah. Well, we'll just have to see. Let's move on to our second story, and that is Google Fiber reaches a new city. Kind of. Not really. Well, sure. Why not? They have, I'm not even going to try to pronounce this because we've had several pronunciations in the chat room. Olathe, Kansas, which is about 25 miles away from Kansas City. So it's not that far away from their current rollout. The city has a population of about 128,000, and it has the same pricing, which is $120 a month for 1 gig up and down, or $70 a month for 1 gig up and down without the HD television service. Now, there's no word if they'll offer the $300 one-time payment for a lifetime of 5 megabit per second download connection, but it seems to be that, maybe we've seen three deployments now. The original Kansas City deployment, the deployment to the second part of Kansas City, and now the deployment to a city 25 miles away from Kansas City. Let me go to you, Curtis. We looked at this as a disruptive move by Google. They wanted something to shock the telco industry or maybe even shame them into providing better service. Do you still hold by that? Is it a disruptive move, or is it, as Eric Schmidt told the press back in December, a real business model that Google plans to expand?
I think it's entirely possible that when Google started this, they were hoping that it would be a disruptive influence. And what they're figuring out is that if it's going to have a real impact on all of the services they offer, then it's going to have to be because it's a Google business. I think that if anything, they underestimated the entrenched lethargy and inertia of the incumbent telcos and the incumbent cable systems. Those companies have what they think that their customers are willing to pay for, at prices that the market is more or less willing to bear. And it's going to take far more than a single proof of concept in the middle of Kansas, or to be honest, on the edge of Kansas, to make them change the way they do business. So if Google wants to see a lot of people streaming lots of data out there, they're going to have to be the ones providing the pipes.
What do you think about this, Oliver? Because it seems as if Google is linking this off of one of their big data centers near Kansas City. That's why they're able to provide such quick rollout. That's why they're able to provide such high bandwidth at low prices. Do you think in order for this to become an actual disruptive move by Google, it needs to roll out into a bigger city or into a city where there are far more competitors from telcos, from Time Warner, from Comcast, from AT&T?
Bottom line, do not care. Yes, and if they have to move away from the middle of nowhere, I mean, if they deploy in Kansas or Juneau, Alaska, or whatever, no way are the telcos even going to care, right? If they go into New York, I used to deal with telcos in New York, and if you call Microsoft the evil empire, you can call Verizon in that particular city this, you know, the absolutely most evil, despicable empire that there is. They own New York, okay? If Google makes an inroad there and actually gets customers there, I'll be impressed, and then I've, you know, then it's a disruptive technology because Verizon will have to react, right? But you know, these middle of nowhere hook up to my cheap data center moves, it doesn't matter.
Right, right. Mitch, let me take this to you because you can give us the other side of the equation, and that is, what would users be able to do with a 1 gig pipe? We like things fast. We like getting a lot of data, but what does it change if, say, an entire metropolitan area in San Francisco or New York suddenly gets low-cost, high-speed internet?
To be honest, I don't know. I don't know what you can push for that one. For myself as a user, I don't think I even generate or even create a demand for that much traffic.
Okay, so it'd be one of those things where it's nice to have, but you don't think the typical user would actually use 1 gig.
No, not at all.
And actually, your sentiment is echoed by the people in the chat room. There are the regular geeks there, like CR1, who, of course, they want to see it rolled out. They want to see that 1 gig pipe. But there's a lot of people who are saying, wait a minute, I'm getting plenty of good service on what I have right now. I don't pay $70 or $120 a month.
Right.
So is Time Warner right? Curtis, throwback to you. Remember Time Warner 2 weeks ago? Their CTO said, customers don't want 1 gig. We've looked, and the market won't bear that price. It won't bear that service. Was she right?
Well, I think the question is whether the market would bear the service the way that Time Warner is likely to price it, or whether the larger market would bear the service at what Google's charging for it now. I mean, I'm paying more than $50 a month for about 10 meg service, and if someone said, hey, for an extra $20 a month you can get gig up and down, would I take it? You betcha. On the other hand, I know that this is one of those areas where a lot of people are very sensitive to the price, especially when it comes to the cable company, and that's largely because of what they see happening with the rest of their cable bill. So to get back to your question, I think that if the cable companies priced it along their normal model, which would include at this point gig service at somewhere around $500 a month, then of course the market's very limited. If they could roll it out at a price similar to what Google's charging, would the market eat it up? I think it would.
Chibert, let me throw over to you for the last word on this topic. Several people in the chat room had mentioned that maybe they would pay it for $70 a month for 1 gig up and down because they're paying close to that for, say, 15, 30, or even 50 megs up and down. If Google were able to roll this out in a major metropolitan area, let's say they linked off of one of their colos near Chicago, would that then force the telcos to change their game, or would it still be a sort of a wait-and-see game?
I got to see a wait-and-see. You know, the cost of running that fiber is just insane. And, you know, we'll see. You know, Google can only make this work when they do it large scale and they don't have to go and negotiate with lots and lots of different people for usage of to hang the fiber on the poles or stick the fiber in the conduits on the ground. This is going to be their biggest problem as they start going into major metro areas, because there's usually no one authority to negotiate with for who gets to hang what on poles or stick in conduits. New York would be a nightmare. Even Honolulu, we had a big unconference not too long ago, and we were talking exactly about this. And in Honolulu, because there's so many different authorities to deal with, we seriously doubt Google Fiber would ever come here. We want it here, but I doubt it's going to come here.
Right. I think the bottom line here is exactly what Oliver stated, which is we really shouldn't care. We could get excited, but we really shouldn't care until Google has proven that they can actually roll out this service in an area that has complicated business relationships, where it's difficult to roll out the fiber, where it's more expensive to roll out the fiber. If the deployment number 4 is a town of 50,000 right next to Olathe, Kansas, then I don't think it's going to be all that disruptive. Let's move on to the last bit of our Enterprise Bite, and that is this nice little story about Twitter being sued for $50 million for not blocking hate speech. Now, this story started back actually last year and into the beginning of this year. The suit was brought by the Union of Jewish French Students. The trouble started last October. There was a rash of anti-Semitic French language tweets and hashtags on Twitter. Now, Twitter complied with a request by the student union to remove the tweets and hashtags by actually going through the French language Twitter pages and removing those users, removing those hashtags. But then the student union went one step further and said, we don't want you just to remove those tweets. We want you to tell us who they are. We want email addresses. We want locations. We want all the information you've collected about those users. Twitter kind of hem and haw. They wanted to look at, okay, do we actually have to do this? What are the privacy ramifications? And now the student union has come back and said, you did not respond within 50 days, and therefore we're suing you for $50 million. It's now in the hands of a French court. Now, this reminds me of Italy arresting two Google executives back in, I believe it was 2006, because Google had a video of bullying up on YouTube. And the French court said, well, you were responsible for that. This is something that we're seeing far more often, where there seems to be a fundamental misunderstanding of what services like Facebook or Twitter or YouTube actually do. Oliver, I want to throw to you first. If this stands, and if this becomes commonplace for services, for common carriers, for social networks to be responsible for what's actually put on their network, what does that do to Web 2.0?
I don't think it's a misunderstanding of what YouTube does. I'm not a lawyer. I'm not sure what the laws are, but I know freedom of speech laws are different in different countries, right? You can't say whatever you want, especially if it's damaging to certain groups, everywhere in the world. That's just America. So, it's on Google, to make sure they're complying with those laws if that stuff is served up in different countries. I think already a precedent has been set for that for other internet sites. So, again, not a lawyer, but if I'm right, then it's on them. I don't know about the $50 million. I think it sounds like students are running that, right? That's a move the kids would make. But, I got a suspicion it's, sadly, it's on Google.
Okay. Curtis, over to you. What does this do to, say, free speech implications? Okay, sorry about that word. If we start holding, let's say, Google Plus responsible for every single post that a user puts up, let's say someone puts up on Google Plus, I hate X, and a student group for X gets upset. If Google can be held responsible each and every single time that happens, it basically kills the business model, doesn't it?
Well, here's where we get into the complication of being an international business. The internet has, for a long time, operated by essentially the rules of the U.S., which are very open. But what we're finding is that gradually more and more countries are deciding that what happens on their soil or happens to their citizens is under the control of their courts, regardless of whether it involves the internet or not. For a company like Google, like YouTube, we're seeing a new thing out just today, Skype with Saudi Arabia. It means that if they're going to make their service available in a particular way for those countries, then they certainly have to abide by the laws of those countries. That makes it awfully complicated. And it makes it, I think, to a point where new companies have to seriously look at all of the countries where they could be seen, all of those countries where they could be accessed, and decide whether they're going to have services particularized for those countries. If they are, then they better have some attorneys on staff who can guide them as far as those nations' laws. The entire world does not operate by the laws of the United States, and most of the world is pretty happy about that.
Mitch, over to you. A Red 5 in the chat room has said, you have to understand how widespread hate of the Jewish people is in France. I'm just having trouble with my words today. Do we really have to take that into account, though? Because, I mean, free speech is free speech. I mean, it might be a big problem in France, but hate speech is hate speech. Trollish speech is trollish speech. Should common carriers be held responsible for what goes on their services other than taking down when they've been informed?
That's a fine line if we cross, right? I mean, you don't want to be too much. You don't want to censor your dialogue too much. At the same time, you need to be sensitive to those. So, again, I have no opinion on it. I think we try to be as openly as possible.
Yep. In
areas like this, it's a red flag or area of concern.
Chibert, over to you. You've done actually some work here in your reporting for Enterprise News on what happens when speech gets impinged upon. What are the chilling effects of saying, I can sue you for not going as far as I would like you to against these people who have offended me?
Da Pavadich. Ooh. You're going to have the KGB calling you right up.
Okay.
No, this is a really big deal. You know, when you start playing with free speech, it's a very slippery slope. And, you know, what these students keep forgetting is, you know, they've got some organizations in France that would absolutely love this kind of power. And, you know, even though I did a little work with the DGSE, they don't want to go down that slippery slope either, because they're going to get bogged down with trying to just police this. Look at what happened to Russia. I mean, really, the KGB became a huge, huge employer just to keep track of who's saying what on what public venue. I don't think we want to go there. So my opinion is, don't do anything. It's free speech. Let it go. You know, if it's in bad taste, yeah, maybe you might want to consider asking them to take it down. But it should be free speech. Let's not turn any spigots on here.
It is free speech, and you know, I think some of these governments would be best to let it go. But Chibert, do you know who's not trying to impinge on your free speech?
No, Padre. Who's not impinging on my free speech?
Well, that would be Ting. You see, Ting is a no BS mobile provider. They use Sprint's towers to give you the service that you want at the price that you need. Just what you're using, nothing more. Now, how is Ting different? You see, the reason why Ting is different is that there are no contracts. There are no early termination fees. It's truly and completely contract-free. Now, there's no bundling or ride-along services. They're not going to try to make you pay a massive price in order to get their service and put a bunch of stuff you're not going to use. You choose from extra small through extra, extra large service levels for voice, minutes, text messages, and megabytes of data, all which are billed separately. There are no overage charges or penalties. If you use more than you thought you would, you just pay for what you used. You also get credits on unused services. If you use less than you thought you would, Ting drops you down to the level you hit and credits the difference on your next bill. Can you imagine a provider actually giving you money back? That's what Ting does. Now, there also are no add-on charges. Voicemail, caller ID, tethering, hotspot, three-way calling, call forwarding, and other features are all part of your service, no additional charge. You get unlimited devices on one plan. You get to share pooled minutes, messages, and megabytes. And each device on a plan costs you a flat $6 per month to access your pool of resources. Ting also gives you a powerful online account control panel. You get to take control of your account, your usage, and your bills in one powerful online control panel. You get to see exactly what you're using it when you're using it. Now, they also give you a no-holds customer support experience. You get to call them at 1-855-TING-FTW anytime between 8 a.m. and 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, and a real person will pick up the phone. You get excellent online support as well at help.ting.com, which has active customer forms, a simple and powerful help ticketing system, video tutorials, video startup guides, and much, much more. Now, here's how Ting works. First, you purchase your mobile device from Ting, which you will receive in 2 to 5 business days. Then you activate your device with Ting, and you have the option to select a new phone number or port an existing one. Finally, you select the monthly minutes, messages, and megabytes that you think represent your usage, and Ting will bill you at the beginning of your payment period. But you will not be charged or credited in the following pay period on anything other than what you've actually used. So here's what I want you to do. If you're listening to me today on the Twit Network, visit Ting at enterprise.ting.com. Save money and better manage your mobile phone usage with Ting. Check out their savings calculator and see how much you or your company can save. Twit viewers also save $25 on your first Ting device when you sign up. So visit enterprise.ting.com and start saving today. And we thank Ting for their support of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Let's get right back to it. We're talking unified communications. We've got this wonderful little article written by, Curtis Franklin from the Enterprise Connect conference last week in Orlando, Florida, who was talking a little bit about, what the newest, the latest, and the greatest is in enterprise communications, specifically unified communication, real-time collaboration, and Microsoft. So I want to throw it to the panel. Let's start with you, Mitch, because you are our resident expert in telecom. When we say UC, when we say unified communications, what are we referring to?
It's a convergence of both voice and video. It's giving you that real true video experience, or actually a collaboration experience. That's what UC is to me. There's tons of people that have different interpretations, but I think UC is that convergence of voice and video.
Okay. Cheebert, when we talk about RTC, real-time collaboration, it's actually something that's been around a long time. From the very first time someone had a face-to-face conversation, they were real-time collaborating. But there's been a lot of buzz in the last two years about RTC, specifically about web RTC. What is that?
Well, web RTC is just an extension of a lot of the programming toolkits for web browsers. HTML5, we've heard this big argument about Flash versus HTML5. Well, one of the things that HTML5 does give us is a richer set of toolkits for opening real-time communications between different browsers. Since we're skipping around, if we could go and hit that webrtc.org demo, there's actually a demo video of a Chrome web page and a Firefox web page actually talking to each other and sending video back and forth. It's actually kind of a cool thing in that the browser has been capable of doing this. There's no reason why, but there wasn't any plumbing behind it. And what these guys are doing is they have two HTML5 enabled browsers with the new WebRTC toolkits behind them, and they're opening up video conferencing. So what we have is we don't need these thick clients anymore. We don't need to have a fully big installation of Skype, or we don't have to have a big installation of an H323 application. We can now open it up from any HTML5 enabled browser, throw some plugins in, and instant video conferencing.
Nice.
So
nice.
It's a nice step forward. How well it will work, don't know yet. It's all experimental at the point.
Oliver, another word that's been thrown around a lot because it's been exploding, as you mentioned before the show, is Link, Microsoft Link. What is Microsoft Link? To the layperson who maybe is just purchasing a brand new version of Office, what is that Link icon that they see?
Actually, I don't think it comes with Office, but I think it comes with Office 365. Link is something I miss. That's one of the most painful things that I missed when I left Microsoft. You become completely addicted to it. It works with your phone. It works with your computer. It works with your mobile phone. Doesn't matter. Everything just connects. You can, as far as deleting or adding people to a conference, it's just there. Click, click, click. Collaborating, boom, document pops up, desktop pops up. It all just works. So yeah, HTML5, that's a cute thing. But as Brian said, it's experimental. So currently, if you just wanted to work, Link is my favorite.
Right. Curtis, I want to go back to you because you actually did write the article that we're using as the foundation for the segment. You talked about how Link has really taken off. We first heard about Link, four years ago? It really started getting out there. We heard rumors of what it could do. It's since then been adopted by everyone from Polycom, Mitch's company, who's sitting right next to me, to companies who are trying to provide services. They're trying to give you everything in one pane of glass, so to speak. So if you're a services company, it combines all your collaborative communication tools along with your database and your calendar and your RTC. Why do you think Link has gained so much traction so quickly, aside from the fact, as Oliver said, it just works?
Well, I think that there are three things at work here. First, as Oliver said, it works. And we can't really discount that when it comes to the enterprise market. People in the enterprise world like solutions that are true solutions and not just hobbies for their employees. The second thing is that it does have the Microsoft back-end structure supporting it. You know, it integrates beautifully well with Windows Server 2012. It can be made to integrate parts of its functionality with the workflow that can come through SharePoint, and it makes sharing documents, workflow forms, all of these things very easy. The third thing is that Microsoft has done with Link what they have done so well with many of their products, and that is they have iterated on a basic idea over and over, making the product better every time until it truly is a very good solution. You know, Link started out as something that was just a voice over IP product. Then it started bringing in things like the Office Communicator functions. It added the video. Presence is a huge deal, being able to let people know whether you are available to be called. You know, all of these things start coming together, all of them tie together into a wonderful package that can be easily integrated, and you have the recipe for a success in the enterprise market. That's what Microsoft has with Link.
Chibert, there's a question in the chat room from Rad, who asked, why did Microsoft buy Skype if Link was going to blow up? I actually had a chance at Enterprise Connect to speak with a Microsoft executive, and I asked him that exact question. And he just smiled, and he said, well, the smart companies are realizing that you can't just focus on enterprise. You need to offer a full spectrum of products. And that's why Microsoft acquired Skype. They want to go everywhere from consumer to enterprise. Do you see that being worked into Link? I mean, I know you were a very early adopter of Link. You had one of the very first servers set up. You really delved into it early. Do you see Link going both into the enterprise and maybe coming down into the consumer space in the form of Skype?
Well, actually, Link has had some odd... It hasn't been fully integrated, but there are gateway capability that you can actually link to Link, yeah. I actually started talking a little bit about it in an InfoWorld article on Link 2010. I actually had a chance to interview the product manager, Francois Dorimou, and very interesting. And what really struck me was the ability to have the scalability to go. We actually did a demo. He actually searched through his federated links, found a person that was still available. The little orb next to his name was green, started a chat, asked if he was willing to do a video chat. And without having to change anything, he opened up a video chat from Honolulu to Georgia. And the HD webcam image was so clear, I could actually see the little curlicues of smoke coming off the guy's cigarette. Now, as Skype becomes more and more part of the Microsoft ecosystem, Skype has a lot of really good technology, not the least of which is there are public servers that allow you to have upwards of, you know, half a dozen to a dozen people in a video call simultaneously, you know, a la Google Hangouts. I've been using it for a while, and there's really no reason why adding that functionality into Link so that Link can go back and forth between Skype and corporate Link through some sort of federated link. I think that's something that we'll probably see. I'm predicting we'll probably see it within the next 6 months to a year. And I think that will be very, very exciting, especially as you start creating these federation links so you can apply business rules on when and how people can use those external links. That way you don't run afoul of regulatory issues on external communications.
Right. Let me throw the very last bit on this segment back over to Mitch. Mitch, there's a couple of people in the chat room who are saying, well, you know, why would you, a Polycom employee, like Link if it seems to be competing with Polycom, right? I mean, doesn't Link take away business from you? Why is Polycom so big on Link if it seems like that could be something that would threaten your business model?
It's yes and no. Polycom's in the business of selling UC infrastructure. So, yes, the bridging infrastructure is a component to that. With Link, we can take advantage and provide Link users the means of UC communications and bridging services. So I think it's a win-win situation for both. We enhance the product a little further, if I could say that. And we're not in the business of competing with a call control platform. Link would do that handily. Like Curtis mentioned, it evolved into a much richer, feature-rich product. But as far as the competition, no, I don't think we're afraid of the competition. We actually work very well together in providing the bridging infrastructure for those Link clients, as well as manufacturing some of the voice endpoints for the Link environment as well.
Yeah, in other words, it's a really big field. It's a really big playing field, and there's a lot of room for a lot of different competitors that are offering slightly different solutions.
Yes. As you look at the enterprise landscape, Link by far, or Microsoft by far, owns that business.
Right.
And with the Link and what it has become is just phenomenal. I mean, the take on Link is just increasing phenomenally. It's just, you know, it's out there everywhere.
Right, right. And, you know, speaking of that vast field of competition in telepresence and telecommunications, I'd like to take some time out to talk about our next sponsor. And that, of course, is Citrix with GoToMeeting with HD Faces. Now, meetings are essential to the way that we want to work. You have to meet with your colleagues, with your friends, with your coworkers, with your clients in order to find out where you need to be, how you stay competitive. Now, sure, we love emails, texts, and attachments. We love the different ways of getting electronic bits of data back and forth to one another, but nothing quite replaces the ability to see someone, to actually interpret their face, their body language, everything when making the important decisions of your business. Meetings done right are an opportunity to share ideas, solve problems, and develop creative solutions. But with the modern workforce spread out over sometimes great distances, meeting face-to-face can be time-consuming, expensive, and often plain impossible. It's those kinds of forced meetings when your team members are made to sacrifice their time and productivity to the meeting that meetings become counterproductive. That's why I use GoToMeeting with HD Faces. It's the powerfully simple way to meet and collaborate online. I like having Citrix as a sponsor because I use GoToMeeting on an almost daily basis. You see, my work used to take me around the four corners of the globe on a weekly basis just to keep in touch with my colleagues. That's days, weeks, and months on the road, all while losing my health, my sanity, and my productivity. GoToMeeting not only allowed me to keep in touch with my colleagues in the field without having to fly to their location, but I would argue that our communication is better now than it was before because we can meet as often as we want to get the work done. Now, here's how it works. You set up your meeting with a few mouse clicks, and everyone receives an email invitation to that meeting. Now, with a single lightweight client that runs on your Mac or PC, tablet, or mobile device, you're in the meeting. With GoToMeeting, you can share the same screen, passing control back and forth to one another, and with the built-in HD video conferencing, online meetings are like being in the same room, with you able to see all the nonverbal communication that is important to doing your thing. Plus, GoToMeeting now makes it possible to present your meeting from an iPad, the ultimate in mobile meetings. I love GoToMeeting. It's easy to use, and with HD Faces, it's just like meeting in person, and I know you'll love it too. So here's what I'd like you to do. I want you to try GoToMeeting free for 30 days. Don't wait. For this special offer, visit GoToMeeting.com, click on the Try It Free button, and use the promo code ENTERPRISE. Be sure to use the promo code ENTERPRISE. GoToMeeting, meeting is believing. And we thank Citrix for their support of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Let's get to the heart of the matter. We're talking all about telepresence and telecommunications. We've hinted to this. The second segment was sort of a primer, but now we're going to get in. It's the prize fight, and we're starting with you, Mitch. When we talk about immersive telepresence versus teleconferencing, what's the difference? Why do we have those two separate categories?
Immersive telepresence is just like being there, right? You get the full video experience. Not only that, the audio component has to be there as well. And then the collaboration aspects, whether you're sharing content via a spreadsheet, a PowerPoint, whatever it may be, or being able to do a whiteboard session. So the immersive telepresence really gives you that capability as if you're just there. Whereas the regular teleconference is kind of like, I don't want to pick on anybody, but having to talk via a Hangout or Skype, that's really the teleconference experience, at least for me. You get the, not the richness, but at least you get the video communications, but immersive telepresence is almost as if you're being there.
Right. Curtis, over to you. Dealing with enterprise executives mostly, do they understand the difference between immersive telepresence and teleconferencing?
I think that they understand the difference. The problem with a lot of people is that they've never really taken part in immersive teleconference. It really is an entirely different world. The basic video call is something that most of us are aware of, even if our use of that technology is heavily dependent on the culture of our particular organization. The truly immersive video conferencing, though, is a high bandwidth, high dollar kind of experience that only the largest enterprises tend to have access to, or at least historically only the largest enterprises have had access to. I think it's going to be interesting to see how developments in technology, how growth of bandwidth will let more companies take advantage of this, and maybe we'll get more people who can actually know what they're talking about when they say they can tell a difference.
Oliver, this has been a long-heard cry that we want video, that we're ready for video, that enterprise, that consumers can use video, will use video, and yet we've seen year and year again, the numbers don't quite match up, the technology isn't quite there. Have we actually gone over the cusp? I mean, is video now expected not just as a feature, but as something that better be part of your collaborative suite?
I'm going to say no, but the funny thing is you work in the Microsoft Office. Every PC is equipped with a camera as a matter of course, and yet no one uses it. Mm-hmm. I've been in maybe one meeting where people asked for video, and most users, A, couldn't figure it out, and B, you know, didn't want their faces shown because they were in bed or something. I don't see it as a pervasive thing just yet. I see CFOs, you know, in my head, I see CFOs trying to be sold on this and just look at the guy going like, why would I spend money on this? My users are more than satisfied with what they have now. Why do I need all this expensive stuff? And honestly, I'm not sure I see the actual tangible value. I think it's a great, for lack of a better word, a luxury, but, you know, exactly being there, if I'm spending all the money, I wouldn't look at it. I mean, I would look at it, but I probably wouldn't do it.
I'm glad you brought that up, Oliver, because that's a prevalent thought, and that is, this is expensive. If I'm going to do immersive telepresence, and I'm not just talking about two guys with a laptop or hooking up via Skype or GoToMeeting, whatever it might be, but actually setting up an expensive, full-featured, high-quality telepresence, I'll call it a real presence room, some people will balk at the price. Mitch, let me go over to you. I'm sorry to ask you a difficult question, but how can you justify that? How can you look at how expensive something like that would be and sell it to a business and say, look, this is what you want, this is what you're going to use?
Again, it really depends on the enterprise and the need for their communications. Not only that, the distance as a barrier between the people that need to communicate. One of the members in the chat room asked about our RPX room. And our RPX rooms are phenomenal. I mean, they literally give you that virtual experience as if you're right in front of talking to a person. In fact, I could be walking in the back of the room and speaking, and the audio components are actually moving with me from the audio experience that they hear. So, you know, that live UC capabilities is great. It's a luxury item, yes. But if you have teams that are traveling, and you know, you travel the four corners of the world, mm-hmm. if you could get that same experience and reduce your travel, your carbon footprint, it's something that has value for the enterprise.
You've got a friend in the chat room, Lou MM, who has actually been on the show. He's an employee at Microsoft. He's one of the coolest guys you'll ever meet. And if you show the product camera, he's mentioning that at Microsoft, they don't go over the computer. They have Polycom phones and headsets, and this is how they collaborate. They use products like this to make it easier to switch between a phone call and a video call or a collaborative call. Now, a product like this, would you put this more in teleconferencing or would you put this in immersive telepresence?
I'll put them more in as a teleconferencing device.
Teleconference. Right?
Something that's on the desktop for the average user. Or, you know, some folks say that would be more of a managerial level.
Yeah, we can't power this up right now because we don't have a PoE brick. But we saw a little bit of this in the demo of the VVX. That's actually, I think, a three-year-old video. And so your products have evolved since then. But one of the nice things about the Polycom system is that you can start with a phone call, SIP initiate it, and then switch it over to a video codec and switch it over to a collaborative, say, laptop conference. Chibert, let me throw this over to you. Do you understand or do you think academia understands the difference between something like this, you know, teleconferencing versus telepresence?
Academia has been using traditional video conferencing for a very long time, especially when we have postdocs traveling all over the world doing their research and then needing to do presentations back to their PhD committees and so forth. Actually, the better question is how much is this used by the military? In 1997, I did a demonstration using broadcast quality video codecs to link a couple of booths at an FCS show in Honolulu. A cadre of admirals actually went running past my booth, and my video just stalled. And they actually had this whole thing. It's like a Stooges act where you got boom, 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 right in. As the four-star stopped in front of my booth to look, and I had these big monitors, and it was clear enough that he almost could imagine being there. And so we actually built a wall for this particular admiral. What he really and truly wanted was these proverbial wall of glass. He wanted something that looked like two conference rooms separated by a chunk of pane of glass. Now, what really makes this kind of interesting is they would leave it up all the time so that the various commanders all around the theater could talk to each other just by walking into the room. They didn't have to fuss around with text because it was always up. They didn't have to fuss around with clipping on microphones because they had microphones that would follow them around. They actually spent a ton of money on things like Gettners for echo cancellers so they could hang a whole bunch of microphones all around the room. The Polycom immersive video system, that wonderful, I think Mitch called it a VVX, I've actually got a chance to try those. Those are amazing. Now, what this kind of system does give you is the flexibility. It gives you the ease of just literally walking into the room. You just schedule the rooms and it's up. Polycom, part of the thing that I learned about the Polycom system is not only is it the hardware of the room, but it's also the service behind it.
Right.
So that
right.
when someone says, I want to go and do a video conference, it's all set up automatically so that the executives just walk into a meeting room. That's pretty powerful stuff, but it's really expensive. Once the price comes down a little bit more, maybe we might see higher adoption. But right now, those video conference rooms, I believe, are fairly rare.
Yeah, that's the virtual NOC services that you're describing, T-Bird. And you're right, they are really expensive. But again, for certain enterprises, and we have tons of them that are out, and, you know, it's more than what you can count on two hands. But I'm sure it's not as numerous as our actual phone endpoints, since those are in the millions. But you're right, and it's the RPX room that really gives you that experience.
Right. There's a lot of people in the chat room who are they're throwing up alternative options. I mean, yes, you could go with Skype. Yes, you could try a Google Hangout. Yes, you could do GoToMeeting. It's interesting. You told me about this before we started the show, and that is Polycom doesn't necessarily see themselves in competition with all the different ways to communicate with video. You're trying to establish a particular niche, and I believe Chibert covered that very well. Mm-hmm. Your hardware is, we call it pricey, but it serves a very specific function and it does it very well. How do you think your solutions, your real presence, your solutions, your teleconferencing, your telepresence, immersive telepresence solutions stack up against what's out there?
Yeah, so thank you for using those branding names. So our real presence platform is truly that. It's the UC infrastructure. And then we have multiple endpoints like our RPX room or immersive telepresence. as well as endpoints that fit and goes down the scale from conference rooms to smaller rooms to the desktop like the VVX phone here. We're in the business of really taking advantage of our UC infrastructure, the bridging component, being able to provide the Hollywood, you know, the Hollywood Squares type of aspect. At the same time, I think the other competitors that are tailoring more toward the consumer market are literally building demand for us for the bridging capability. So, you know, the mobile tablets, the applications that are on this, on the tablets and iPhones and all the other smart devices. Polycom also has what we call a Real Presence Mobile that's available for both the Android and iPhone variants, and they're available on the app stores. But again, it's really for a consumerized play where you're doing point-to-point video. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, once people experience point-to-point video and get used to it and comforted, they want to do more. They want to collaborate with more people. They want the bridging capabilities. So that's where it evolves into really a UC infrastructure that we manufacture.
Right, right. I want to move into the next bit of topic about this, and that is immersive telepresence versus straight-up video conferencing. There were two articles about an IDC report that were basically looking at the year-over-year growth of immersive telepresence. So that's the high-end telepresence that we've been talking about. And it basically, we're seeing a top out around $700 million a year of business, the lion's share, the vast share, which is owned by Cisco and Polycom. But what they've seen is a slowing of growth, not negative growth, but a slowing of growth in favor of more consumer-based technologies. As you mentioned, we're seeing more use of tablets. We're seeing more use of mobile devices. We're seeing more use of, say, Link on the desktop. I want to throw this to Oliver first. Oliver, when we see the slowing of the super high-end telepresence systems and an increase in the growth of let's call them teleconferencing devices and teleconferencing services, what does that tell you as an analyst? What does that tell you about where we're headed for video in the enterprise?
I'd have to read that report, but I'd probably, based on my experience, disagree with that. I've got a medium business mindset, right? So I'd have to put myself in an enterprise, you know, CTO's place who has millions of dollars to burn. But even those guys, I mean, every study I read, everything says you have to do more with less, even enterprise CTOs, more with less, more with less, more with less. I don't see them opting to use this when they have much cheaper options. I mean, Link isn't inexpensive, but it does have the video if you want it. Microsoft did put out that goofy, you know, camera that they, again, they have it in every conference room. Again, nobody uses it. The one with the multiple lenses to get everybody in the room with facial recognition, blah, blah, blah. I don't see that being used. And I think they only use it because, you know, it's theirs. I would have to disagree. I don't think that's growing. And I'm expecting it, in fact, to take a decline.
Wow. Okay. I like this. That's thank you for the honesty, Curtis. Let me throw it over to you. We just spent an entire week at Enterprise Connect, so both of us are kind of filled with the buzzwords. We're filled with the PR releases. But what if video is shrinking? What if the enterprise is pulling back? I mean, do you actually see that?
Well, I think what we may well see is sort of the high end, if you will, formal video conferencing shrinking for at least a bit. We know that business travel has gone back up. And I think we could see the formal video conferencing starting to go down. But I think that in many organizations, what we're starting to see is a rise in what we'll call casual teleconferencing, casual one-to-one or perhaps small work group video conferencing, using the quality that's available through Skype, through Google Plus Hangouts, and through the various public transport systems like that. Here's what I think is happening. In the same way that the telephone gave us one level of acceptable audio quality for calls, then cell phones gave us a still lower level that people were willing to deal with. We're starting to see people's idea of what is acceptable video go down. For the longest time, the only video they really saw was television, and that's a very high quality standard for most enterprise or personal systems to match. Now that people are becoming more used to things like FaceTime from Apple, Google Plus, Skype video, they're seeing that they can have an acceptable video experience with a much lower video resolution and quality. That's why I think that companies are looking at this point-to-point, person-to-person casual video as something that they're willing to allow and even encourage, while the high-dollar systems, they are taking a much deeper look at and a much longer look at when it comes to most buying cycles.
Mitch, I want to throw this over to you. And I don't like beating up on guests, but these are really good points, both what Oliver and Curtis are bringing up, and that is people are looking to save money. People are looking for good enough quality. People will look at Skype to do interviews. People will look at GoToMeeting to do collaborative efforts. People will look at Link because it's, say, built into their enterprise network as it is. So if that's the case, where does that leave Polycom? And let me go one step further. Polycom has a unique position in the immersive telepresence and in the video conferencing field because, A, you're one of the only single players left. Most of the other players have been acquired. B, you use open standards. Yes. You believe in letting others use your technology. So where does that put you manufacturing both really high-end, mid-end, and even sort of consumer-level peripherals for video conferencing, video presencing?
I'm going to start with this. Curtis mentioned some interesting topics, and obviously some of that has been realized. But much like the cell phone, I mean, we've lowered our tolerance to the audio experience, right? People that were very mobile would experience a lot of dropped calls, and we've learned to accept that. I think with the consumer markets, or at least the folks that are using Google Hangouts, Skype, they are, again, tolerating the lower video experience. Much like what HD Voice did for the audio components, where you get that high fidelity, people start appreciating that. And I think as people start using more enterprise-grade UC or infrastructure or just enterprise-grade video capabilities, they'll start to demand that need. And I think that's where the demand for video is starting to go up. Not only that, there's other personal habits. I think women are very self-conscious of, you know, being on camera, and I think that's where usability is being rejected. At the same time, from a person that actually managing people or somebody that really is interested in seeing what type of body language is conveyed, like an interview, or even speaking to your direct reports, I think that's where video starts building confidence. Right. And then the last thing I think would be the ease of usability. So in the past, video has never been a simple thing to fire up and conduct. Well, I think today we're making more improvements in making that simplified. I mean, being able to walk into a conference room and like what Brian hinted, Tiebert has hinted to, where the VNOC would have the meeting already queued up. Well, with our endpoints, our HDX is our group series, and how we integrate with Microsoft Link, when that calendar comes around, that resource in Link is already well aware of that conference, and it'll actually be ready to start. So the user simply presses a join meeting and the meeting is the video conference has started. So usability would be another thing. But I think where we're at with the familiarity of consumers with the available applications, I think that will build the demand for UC infrastructure.
Tiebert, I want to throw over to you because both of us have used Polycom equipment extensively. And I have to say, the gear that I used from Polycom even 5 years ago still outstrips most of the gear and services I use today, even some of the really high-end, say, cloud-based, non-premise-based services and offerings. But yes, there's a price to it. Now, my question to you is, do people understand what you get for the increased price? Can they conceptualize the increased quality, the ease of use, you know, that ability to not have the 5 minutes at the beginning of every meeting where you're fumbling with technical issues, but you've just done something as simple as dial a phone number and hit video? Do people get that, or is that sort of lost in translation?
Well, what you're seeing on the screen is a product that I played with way back when it was produced by Microsoft. This is called the Microsoft Roundtable. It is now a Polycom product. It's a very sexy webcam and speakerphone. And what it does is it actually takes five webcams, hits a 45-degree mirror, and stitches it together into a 360-degree panorama. And by using the directional microphones, it will actually do a digital tilt, pan, and zoom so that whoever's talking around a round table, it will automatically center on their face. I love it. It's a really, really cool product, but it is very expensive and did not sell great. So one of the things that a lot of people say is the technology has been there for quite a while. There's a lot of really cool things that can be done, but is the market really ready for it? And I guess it really starts coming down to, is it good enough? Can a $60 Logitech HD cam do just as well? Now, one thing I do want to point out to a lot of viewers is that setting up this, just my laptop for Skype, has been kind of a pain. We always have Skype problems. Skype is not real tolerant of jitter. So one of the things that you start getting on the commercial systems like H323, the traditional video conferencing, is they will sacrifice video in favor of audio, but they have some very, very sexy forward error correction built in. And that's what Link is all about. Link has some amazing forward error correction. So it's almost an in-between of, you know, it's not Skype, it's not H323, it's something in between. And I can see a lot of merging of the two technologies.
Yeah, yeah. All right, I want to go one last time around the horn just to sort of wrap this up. Oliver, I really do appreciate sort of the honesty that you brought to this, because I think I tend to gush. I love the technology. I've played with it a lot, especially at Interop. But you really give us a nice perspective of, if I'm buying this for my business, this is what I would actually do. My question to you is this. What would need to change for you to start considering one of the higher-end solutions? What would have to change either about the way you do business or the pricing structure of gear or the service structure offered by, say, Polycom, Cisco, Tanberg, whatever it might be?
For me, it would have to be two things. One, the price would have to come down, and two, I would have to see my partners, maybe my customers, adopt this more. This really, as an internal only feature, even if I was in an enterprise, I'd have to question it, right? If it's something I can use with customers to impress them or to communicate with them on a deeper level, then I would consider it. But again, most times I don't think you're going to find that, right? I think the vast majority of people aren't using it. So unless penetration improves and, you know, more universality is seen in this, I don't see it really being much of a factor.
Curtis, same question to you with a slightly different bent, and that is, dealing with executives as you do at Enterprise Efficiency, what do you think executives need to be convinced about before they make the buy-in, before they actually dedicated the resources, the manpower to implement immersive telepresence, real presence, or teleconferencing?
Well, I think that what it's ultimately going to come down to for most executives is the bottom line, as it tends to. Will we be able to save enough money in travel costs, for example, to justify this? That's the basic trade-off that that teleconferencing salespeople have been using for years and years. It's the travel versus teleconferencing trade-off. But it's really more than that, because I think what we get down to is, will there be enough of a difference made in face-to-face, where I can see the face of someone I'm talking to, and in, to get back to UC, to sharing desktops, to sharing open screens? Can we collaborate in a way that makes a difference? Now, I'm going to mention one thing that I think would help with this, and that is, Oliver mentioned greater universality. Beyond the fact that a lot of people need to use this, we need to have better ways for people not to care which teleconferencing system their customers, their partners, their suppliers are using. Right now, you have to care, and that's a problem. When we can have systems that make it such that any system can call any system, that will be a day when we can see really dramatically greater growth in the immersive video conferencing field.
Chibert, I want to throw over to you, and I think you and I both come from the same background, and that is engineering geeks. We have gear that's thrown into our laps, and we just love to see what we can do with it. So my question to you is, looking at the gear that's coming out from Polycom and from others, the latest in Cisco gear that we got to play with 2 years ago at Interop. Some of the lower-end gear that we're seeing at events like Enterprise Connect that is starting to give the higher-end telepresence rooms a run for their money. What's going to happen in the next 1, 2, 3 years when we have, like, say, a standards-based company like Polycom versus a more proprietary-based company like, let's say, Cisco? And I really shouldn't be mentioning names here, but I'm going to do it anyways. What do you expect to see? Put on your journalist hat here.
I'm expecting to see more and more convergence. You know, we got to keep in mind, one of the things that we demonstrated at Interop in the iLab several years ago was how to make several UC systems start talking to each other. What is, in my mind, the most powerful feature of UC is actually presence, where you can actually know beforehand, is the person busy? Is the person in a meeting? And being able to apply business rules to it, I think, is amazingly powerful. You know, one of the examples I put into my article was you can make yourself busy, but set up a business rule that your team can send you text messages. So if you're going into a meeting and your team needs to feed you those last minute budget numbers, that's pretty powerful. Being able to say, I'm in Paris, don't disturb me because I'm sleeping. We've wanted the ability to set time zone sensitivity in our cell phones for years and years and years. But it hasn't quite happened yet, but it's getting there. I'm going to start saying we're going to start seeing convergence. We're going to start seeing more and more products being able to talk to each other. Federation is better understood now. It's going to be clumsy at first because they're going to be gateways. But as people start demanding, people wanting to use it, people wanting to say, I don't want to leave a voicemail message. I want to know immediately whether they're in a meeting. That's a great thing. And one of the cool things that the product manager from Link told me was his number of hours of voicemail has gone down by nearly a factor of 100, because now within the Microsoft organization, why leave a voicemail when you know the person's busy? Why even call in the first place? So send them a chat, send them an email, or if they're not busy, do a video conference. I think convergence. I think that's where we're going to start seeing a lot of interesting things.
Mitch, I give you the last word. Thank you for coming into the studio. Where do you see Polycom playing? Because, again, you are in a unique position, being standards-based, being open, being the player that still works alone, that still gets to sort of define your own path. Seeing the pressure from consumer end products, seeing the pressure from something like Link, which got so much market share so quickly, where do you see the future of devices like this, of teleconferencing devices and telepresence systems?
Well, for what I see for the immediate future is, you know, we've all accepted VoIP, and it's part of everybody. It's ubiquitous now. And I think for service providers that are doing hosted voice, they'll actually take our endpoints and really penetrate the market further by providing video capabilities. That's where I think for the near term where we're headed. For the service provider market, that will be providing true UC to the masses. And as far as, again, once people become comfortable with using it, the enterprise community at large will really pick up and use video conferencing.
Right. Now, I'm going to make this promise to you. We're going to have you back because we are going to get far more into UC. We're going to get way more into enterprise connectivity. I want to bring in a couple of different vendors and let you have it out. Will you accept that invitation?
Yeah, I think we'd be excited about doing something like that.
Okay. But before we go there, I do want to thank the last sponsor of the show. Now, did you know that when Leo built the brick house, he decided that everything should be in the cloud? Our email was in the cloud. Our scheduling was in the cloud. And so when Russell, our IT guy, came to us and said that there was a way to put our phone system in the cloud to get a full-featured PBX without having to install anything here at the Brick House, well, it was a no-brainer. We love RingCentral. There are zero startup costs. There's no PBX hardware to install or maintain. RingCentral allows us to easily customize all of our call handling. Our producers get their voicemail in their email, and we can even get all of our fax messages right on our smartphones. And now they have a brand spanking new feature, Business SMS. Now you can send text messages to your customers and colleagues from your business phone number. No more using your personal number. It all looks professional. Now, RingCentral offers all-inclusive pricing, as low as $20 per month per user. You can start right now with a 30-day risk-free trial, and they have a special offer for my listeners. When you buy one desk phone, you get a second phone free up to 20 phones. So call this number, designated for my listeners, 800-543-9980. That's 800-543-9980. Once again, for good luck, 800-543-9980. Or you can go to ringcentral.com and use the promo code TWIT. That's ringcentral.com, promo code TWIT. And as an extra special bonus, this month is the 137th anniversary of the first telephone call. RingCentral conducted some market research and has some interesting stats on how much has changed since then, especially for work. For example, nearly 80% of adults now use their mobile phones to text for business, with 32% even closing business deals via text. Check out RingCentral's infographic with more interesting stats like this at blog.ringcentral.com. And we thank RingCentral for their support of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Now, you've used up another hour listening to This Week in Enterprise Tech. I want to thank all of our panelists, starting with you, Oliver. Oliver, you know, I love when we have you on because you are honestly the voice of reason, the voice of honesty. Tell us, what are you doing? What can people find? Where can people find your work?
Publicly available, not very far. There's not a lot of it out there right now. I just did an Office 365 review that went up on I helped with it, actually. It went up on InfoWorld got a couple of weeks ago. And once again, I'm looking at Windows Server Essentials at this point, although that's been out for so long, I now have to change the focus to having lived with it for a while. So that's a very different perspective than, hey, this is what the basic feature set is. So I think that'll be an entertaining review.
Fantastic. Over to you, Curtis. What's going on in enterprise efficiency? I know you're traveling. I know we just did a live show last week. What do you have coming up next week?
Well, next week, as I said, I'll be down in Orlando once again at SNW. That's a storage, to be honest, networked storage and business intelligence show. A lot of CIOs. I'm going to be live blogging. So if people are curious about what's going on there, ask them to check over at enterpriseefficiency.com later this week. I'll have my schedule up. Would love for them to follow me. Let me know their comments and questions while I'm down there.
And Chibert, the geek in paradise, the man with the sometimes frozen Skype account. What's going on in Hawaii?
Well, happy Easter, everybody. And for those people in Hawaii, tomorrow is Prince Kuhio Day, one of the many extra holidays that Hawaii folks get because we're celebrating our basically the royal history of the Hawaiian island chain.
It's a party day, let's be honest.
Tonight would be the party night.
Yes, okay. And our other Hawaiian, Mitch, thank you again for coming on. Thank you for coming into the studio, for driving up. It's always a pleasure to talk to you. But what are you working on? Where can people find out more about Polycom? Where can people find out more about topics like immersive telepresence?
That's easy. That's www.polycom.com. What I'm working on is just the typical daily Polycom grind.
Just the geek stuff.
Just the
geek stuff. And you know what? We're going to have more when we start doing our interop coverage. Now, I also want to thank everyone here at the Brick House who has made this show possible. Of course, that's Jason, our superb TD, who herds cats and makes this show actually work. Karsten, my super producer, but also all the engineers who put everything together to make This Week in Enterprise Tech just work. Now, I want to reach out to you, specifically to the people who are listening to this show on a download. Did you know that we do this show live every week? That's right. On Monday at noon Pacific time, you can go to live.twit.tv and find out exactly how this show was put together. You'll be able to see things that happen before the show and after the show. You'll be able to see things that we get to cut out. You see, we like to show you how the sausage is made. Now, while you're there, why not log into our live chat room? That's right. Twit has one of the most engaged chat rooms still left on the planet at irc.twit.tv. There you'll be able to find people who have just been with Twit since the beginning, some of the most brilliant engineers and some of the funniest trolls. Yes, I'm talking about you, Red 5 and Foreign Source. Also, why not drop by our Twiat YouTube page at youtube.com/Twiat. We're dropping all of our new videos there, and you'll be able to, contact me directly. hit me up in the comments and I will reply as soon as I find a connection. Also, you can follow me at Twitter, at twitter.com/PadreSJ. In fact, I'd love for you to follow me on Twitter so that we can converse about future topics for the show and you can ask your questions about what's been going on in the life of the digital Jesuit. Finally, I want to thank CyberDog in the chat room for doing our show notes. He really does help us put things to paper so that it can make more sense when you're watching us later on. I'm Father Robert Ballasaire, and I'm reminding you, if you want to know what's going on in the Enterprise, just keep quiet.